My name's Dwayne. We've been talking about these parables in the Gospels. Jesus taught in parables. He taught in parables because it was easier for people to understand, but it was also harder for people to understand. He taught in parables to sort of disguise the truth, so there was always something surprising and always something a little unexpected in these parables. And these parables we've been looking at have to do with the kingdom. And so why was Jesus teaching on the kingdom? Well, because like we sang about this morning, our prayer, our ask of God is that you would build your kingdom here. We want this place to look more and more like the kingdom of God. And that happens when we start to adopt some of the postures that Jesus talks about in these parables. So we're going to talk about a parable today. But before we do, I have a little question to get your brain working. When is inaction action? That's my question to start with. When is doing nothing actually doing something? And I'll prime it a little bit more. Some of you know that I teach music at the university. How many of you know what one of these symbols are, or both of these symbols? You know what these symbols are? You should all thank a music teacher if you know what these symbols are. Good for you. These are musical rests, right? These are symbols that are indicated in a score that tell you something very specific to do. And what they tell you to do is to do nothing. At that moment, when you see that symbol, at that point in the musical time, you do nothing. But it is an action. It is a command, because if you ignored it, then you'd be doing something you shouldn't be doing, right? But if you do what that says, you do nothing, and you're doing something right. So in that instance, inaction is the correct action. Well, we're going to talk about a parable today that actually has to do with forgiveness. And you'll see the connection here. And we're going to talk about how forgiveness is really an action that is about inaction. It's not something so much that you do, but it's not doing something that you are otherwise entitled to do. That's what forgiveness is. We're going to talk about the act, the action, because Jesus told a great story to illustrate it, and we read it a lot. Some of you may be familiar with it, but I think there's a couple of hidden things in here that might be kind of interesting. It all started because Peter asked a good question. In Matthew 18, Peter came to Jesus and asked, "Lord, how many times shall I forgive my brother or sister who sins against me? Up to seven times?" Now let me put that in context. You see, other rabbis in Jesus' day taught that it's a really good practice to forgive your brother three times. Right? Because the law says, well, here's how it works. Someone offends you or sins against you, then the judge decides what an equal and fair retribution would be, and then you're allowed to give that retribution to the other person. They have to pay you or they have to whatever it is, right? But the rabbis in Jesus' day taught, no, we should forgive, and we should do it three times. So Peter knew this, and so Peter was going to Jesus. He was trying to be a little bit gracious and maybe pat himself on the back a bit by saying, how many times should we forgive? Let's say maybe up to seven. Not only did he double it, he upped it one more to get to that perfect biblical seven. Seven is like, it's the symbol of perfection. So basically, Peter is saying, I know seven is the perfect number, and that's, should we forgive our brother or sister seven times? But then Jesus threw this answer at him. He says, I tell you, not seven times, but 77 times. Now, what's interesting about that is some of you may know this verse and you may think, wait a minute, I thought he said 70 times 7. Well, we're not really sure exactly what he said. And it's a translation issue, and here's why. Because in Greek, it says one thing. In Greek, the Greek would say 70 times 7. The Hebrew would say 77. And there were two different versions of the Old Testament in Jesus' day. One was in Hebrew, and then the Septuagint was around, which was in Greek. So Jesus was actually quoting something from Genesis, we think, in Genesis 4, where somebody named Lamech was offended, and it says basically, Lamech was offended seven times, and I tell you he will be avenged 77 times. But if it's the Septuagint, then the Septuagint says 70 times 7. So we're not really sure if Jesus was quoting the Hebrew or the Greek. All this doesn't make any difference to you at all. Here's the point. What he really wanted to say was that. It's not about the number. It's not about 77 or 70 times 7, even though there's a large difference between 490 and 77. The point is, let's take that 7 and let's up the ante. We're going to explode it. We either add another 7 to make it 77, or we multiply it times 70 to make it. You get the picture? Jesus is trying to say, it doesn't matter. You're not going to count. right? And if he had lived after the early 17th century, when this guy, John Wallace, was around who invented the infinity symbol, he might have used the infinity sign, but he didn't because he didn't have that. He just said 77 or 70 times 7. So that's the setup. Peter says, how many times? 7? And Jesus says, infinity. Now, let me tell you, Jesus says, now let me tell you a story to further reinforce that. Here's what he says. Therefore, the kingdom of heaven is like a king who wanted to settle accounts with his servants. As he began the settlement, a man who owed him 10,000 talents was brought to him. Okay, 10,000 bags of gold, or 10,000 talents is the translation there. I have to pause here because we gloss over this one too. We don't know how much that was. A talent, or a bag of gold, was the amount that a servant would make over 20 years of his life. 20 years of his life was represented by one bag of gold or one talent. And this servant owed the king 10,000 bags of gold. That's 200,000 lifetimes of earnings. To put this in today's dollars, for someone who makes minimum wage in Delaware at this moment, that would be like owing $3.5 billion. This guy was in debt. He had a shopping problem. No, I'm kidding. You can't rack up that much debt. I don't care who you are. $3.5 billion? Even if he took out a loan, A, would the king really loan him $3.5 billion? That doesn't matter. But B, what would he do with it? The point here is Jesus is being absurd. If we miss that, we miss the whole point of the parable. The point of the parable is this guy owed $3.5 billion. You know, just pulling a number out of the air. That's a lot of money. So, he was not able to pay. The master ordered that he and his wife and his children and all that he had be sold to repay the debt. Also important to know that this was just simple standard operating procedure. If you could not pay the debt to the king would try to recoup that debt by selling your assets, meaning your family, and trying to recoup some of that debt. The king wasn't being mean. The king wasn't being vindictive. He wasn't punishing. He was saying, you can't pay the debt. This is the consequence of that. The servant fell on his knees before him. Be patient with me, he begged, and I will pay back everything. The servant's master took pity on him, canceled the debt, and let him go. That's part one. But then Jesus paints a picture of something else that happens to sort of contrast that. But when that servant, the one who was forgiven the $3.5 billion debt, he goes out and he found one of his fellow servants who owed him 100 silver coins. Okay, Dwayne, how much is 100 silver coins? Good question. A silver coin was what a servant might make in one day. So that's about 100 days worth of minimum wage, which we can look in today's dollars is about $6,000. Not a small amount, probably, but compared to $3.5 billion, it's not even like half of the interest on one payment or something, right? I mean, it's just the contrast here is absurd. He was owed $6,000, 100 silver coins, grabbed him and began to choke him. He had an anger issue here. Pay back what you owe me, he demanded. His fellow servant fell to his knees and begged him, be patient with me and I will pay it back. But he refused. Instead, he went off and had the man thrown into prison until he could pay the debt. Again, normal legal procedure here. Debtor's prison was a normal thing when you couldn't pay your debt and the person you owed it to couldn't sell you because they didn't own you. Then you would go to debtor's prison. When the other servants saw what had happened, they were outraged and went and told their master everything that had happened. So now he gets told on, right? So now he gets called back in by the king, by the master. You wicked servant, he said. I canceled all that debt of yours because you begged me to. Shouldn't you have had mercy on your fellow servant just as I had on you? In anger, his master handed him over to the jailers to be tortured until he should pay back all he owed. This is how my heavenly Father will treat each of you unless you forgive your brother or sister from your heart. We're going to get to that in a second. So I want to talk about this for a second because the $3.5 billion is really, really important. It's important to understand the exaggeration. It's important to understand that the point of this parable, and usually parables generally had one point. If you analyze too many layers of the parable, you get caught in the weeds and you don't really see the truth that Jesus is trying to say. So towards the end there, when the king had the guy thrown into prison and tortured and Jesus says, hey, that's what God's going to do to you, that's not the point of the parable. God's not vindictive. God is not going to be angry and lash out at you. The point here is what Jesus is setting up here is he's saying, look at how much has been done for you. Look at what has been forgiven for you. And again, we know that Matthew, the Gospel of Matthew, is written to Jewish people. And so these words are meant specifically for a Jewish audience. A Jewish audience that has tried through the years to be faithful and has continually failed. And the prophets have continually said, there will be judgment, there will be judgment. And Jesus is saying, guess what? Forgiveness is at hand. Look at the size of the debt that has been forgiven you. So doesn't it just make sense that you would forgive someone else, the 6,000? When 3.5 billion has been wiped clean? Well, I want to talk a little bit about that word forgiveness, because to further understand and to underscore what Jesus is talking about, we need to look at a little bit of a word study here. Aphiemi is the Greek word that is translated here, forgive. It is important to know that it is a verb. It is an action word. It is something that you do. But the tricky thing about this word is it's used... I have it written down here somewhere. How many times? 146 times in the New Testament this word is used, and only 49 times is it translated as some form of the word forgive or forgiveness. It's a really unusual word, and it has a lot of meanings and a lot of applications. I'm just going to throw some of them up here for you. It could mean abandoned or to allow or allowed. It could mean to divorce. Paul uses it when a man divorces a wife. It can mean forgive, forgave, forgiven, forgives. It can mean to give permission. It means leave. It's translated to leave as 7 times or left. It left or he left. To permit, to send away, to tolerate. It's translated all kinds of different ways. Let me give you some verses to kind of give you some of the context. And these are all from Matthew. Just so you know, it's the same author using the Greek word in so many different ways. Matthew translates it or uses it in these sentences. When Jesus called the disciples, at once they left their nets and followed him. Same Greek word as forgive. They left, they dropped them, they went away from them. Okay? He touched her hand. He was healing someone, Jesus was. He touched her hand and the fever left her. Same word as forgive. Left, went away. Leave them, Jesus says. In other words, leave them alone. Let them be. He's talking about the Pharisees. He says, leave them. They are blind guides. If the blind lead the blind, both will fall into a pit. So put them aside. Get rid of them. Jesus said, let the little children come to me. Same word, to allow, to let. Fascinating, isn't it? And then Jesus says this, woe to you teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites. You give a tenth of all your spices, but you have neglected the more important matters of the law, justice, mercy, and faithfulness. Neglect to not pay attention to, right? So that's, again, same word. And when Jesus had cried out again in a loud voice, he gave up his spirit. The idea in regard to the spirit, that the spirit leaves, the spirit is separated. So what does all this mean? This means that this word that we have translated as forgiveness is basically to separate, to leave. Leave behind the nets. The fever left. We leave it alone. It's a fascinating thought to think about all those different uses of the word forgive. And especially when we think about the idea that forgiveness is an action, it is that action of inaction that I was talking about earlier. It is to do something that is doing nothing, that is to not do what you might otherwise rightly be entitled to do to someone who offends you. And it is to separate that person from the consequences of that action from as far as the east is from the west. Right? That's what it says in Psalm 103. This is what God did for us. He took that $3.5 billion and he removed it from us so far. As far as the east is from the west, and it's an expression that was used in Hebrew culture to mean the farthest distance that you can imagine. There is no reconciling east and west. You can be one or the other. And so to separate your sin from you that far is a huge act of grace and mercy, and that is what God has done for you. And that's the setup of the parable. That's the point. Jesus is saying, look at what God has done for you. Look at all he has given you. As far as the east is from the west. So one of the things that we think about this morning is that forgiveness is an action. It's an action that God has taken with you, but this parable was only partly about what God has done for us. That's the basis. Understanding what God has done for us is important. But then we take that and we have to apply it, because he says, look, now don't you turn around and not forgive somebody else. How often does Jesus teach something and we hear the disciples scratching their heads saying, Jesus, wow, this is a hard teaching? I think if Jesus was here today and was telling the story, we might do the same thing. We might scratch our heads and say, Jesus, this is a hard teaching. Forgiveness is hard. You don't know how much I've been hurt or wounded, right? So, this is what Jesus says. He says, the first thing, keep in mind the action that God has taken against you, the inaction, right? He has taken no action. He has removed your sin from you. But the second thing here is, I'm fascinated in this story about how angry this guy got, because there's obviously an obstacle to forgiveness, and Jesus is trying to get at that a little bit too. And the obstacle here that was illustrated is this guy's anger. And he gets forgiven this great debt, and the way Jesus tells it, it's like he walks out the door and the first thing he does is find some dude and grab him by the neck. Give me my money, right? Well, I don't know if it was that fast or not. That's not the point. Jesus wasn't necessarily giving a specific timeline. But I started to think to myself, what is it that makes people so angry about being wronged, even in spite of the fact that we've been forgiven so much? What is it that makes me angry at people? Why do I get angry and irritated at people who do wrong things when I try hard to keep in mind that I've been forgiven $3.5 billion worth, right? And I begin to think that there's a sense in which I don't want to vilify this guy, because I think this guy could easily be any one of us, the guy who gets angry. So in trying to not vilify him, I'm trying to figure out what might be happening here. And what I imagined in my own life and in my own heart was, when I've been forgiven something, let's say I make a mistake that nearly costs me dearly, but I get forgiven and I get a break and I get a second chance, I become really grateful for that. And I even become a little bit humble. Right? There's a humility involved with that. And so the next thing that I try to do is I try to channel my energy into really focusing on whatever it was I messed up so I don't make that mistake again. And when I channel my energy into that, I get better at it probably. And I, as I do better at whatever it was that got me in trouble in the first place, then I begin to see that in other people's lives more and more. And I have a tendency in my worst moments to start judging other people for the very thing that I am working on getting better at. And I'm judging them not based on where I was. I'm judging them based on the fact that I've worked really hard to get better at this. And then I start to become self-righteous. And I start to think, well, if I can get better at this and if I can do it, then you can too. And then that self-righteousness turns into anger. And before you know it, I want to grab somebody by the throat and say, stop doing that thing. But it was exactly what I was doing before. And I don't know if any of you guys track with that, but I see that pattern in my life on more than one occasion where my forgiveness is, it's not a bad intention thing, right? My forgiveness leads me to a place where I work really hard to try to get better at that thing, but if I let that turn into self-righteousness, it gets really nasty. So that, to me, is the worst danger here. And to me, that's the anger problem, is that you get this forgiveness, which turns into humility, which turns into self-improvement, which is a good thing, but then gone awry, it turns into a little bit of self-righteousness and ultimately anger. And I think maybe, who knows, but maybe that was the trajectory that this guy was on. He got forgiven, and I don't think maybe he wasn't just such a nasty person that he went out and just did something bad. I think maybe there was a little bit of human nature in there. So we have to understand that forgiveness is an action that we have to take in other people's lives and in our own life, but it's also hindered by that self-righteous anger, right? And so the story tells us not to be that way. But then the next thing that I want to talk about in the story, I'm fascinated by this. What is required to make this whole forgiveness thing work? What do we see in Jesus' story? Well, we see two things. In verse 26 and verse 29, we see the same request coming from both servants. The first servant fell on his knees, begged, please be patient with me. I will pay back everything. The second servant, he went to his fellow servant, fell to his knees, and begged, "Be patient with me. I will pay it back." Now, what's fascinating to me about this parable is that it seems in this particular story, Jesus is talking about the kind of forgiveness that you give to someone when they ask for it. I think there are other teachings of Jesus that apply to situations where people have not been repentant or they've not asked for forgiveness, and we have to learn to love our neighbors as ourselves. We have to learn to turn the other cheek. We have to learn to do not resist an evil person, right? These are all teachings of Jesus from Matthew just a few chapters earlier. So I think that that's there. But in this story, I think he's really talking about something else. I think he's talking about a reconciliation that happens when someone comes and asks to be forgiven of a consequence. Let me backtrack a little bit to kind of explain a bit more about the legal system. It's kind of important to understand this too. In Jesus' day, the law didn't work the way it does today. There was this principle that a lot of law is based on called the lex talionis, and the lex talionis was basically a law of retribution. Okay, we see it in Hammurabi's code. We see it in the Old Testament. And the idea is an eye for an eye. And we've talked about this in here before, but an eye for an eye sounds pretty brutal and gruesome to us. But in fact, it was actually to ratchet down the stakes, right? Because before this code of retribution, it was basically, okay, you stole one of my sheep, so I'm going to take all my strong men over to your village and I'm going to slaughter your whole family, right? And the punishment didn't fit the crime. Right. Well, in Hammurabi's code, this idea of lex talionis and what the Old Testament really talks about in an eye for an eye is the punishment has to fit the crime. So if you steal a sheep, then that other person either owes you a sheep. If you steal a sheep, then you owe them a sheep or you owe them the monetary amount of a sheep. Right. And that was the judge's job. The judge's job was to say, here is the retribution, and now you carry it out. It wasn't like you stole a sheep, so the government is going to take you and they're going to punish you. That's the way it works in our society, but this is a retribution-based kind of a system. So this idea of forgiveness isn't about a state of mind. It's not about an emotional state. It's not about, oh, I used to think bad thoughts about you, but now I'm going to start to think nice thoughts about you because I forgive you. It actually has a lot more to do with the retribution, with the idea of here is what is due. You deserve this because you have offended in this way. That was the idea of an eye for an eye in the lex talionis. And so what Jesus is talking about here, again, remember these kingdom parables are always about flipping something on its head. And he just, again, a few verses earlier in the Gospel of Matthew, gave his famous teaching on, you've heard it said, an eye for an eye, and I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If someone forces you to walk a mile, walk two. If someone asks for your coat, give them your shirt as well. Jesus is clearly teaching against that by saying, don't even ask for retribution. So, in this parable, these men have asked for forgiveness. They have asked to be exempted from what otherwise they deserved because they owed the money. It was legally owed to them that they should get this punishment, and they're asking to be exempted. And Jesus tells the story in such a way that we see the hero of the story, or the one that we want to emulate, forgives. Not only does he be patient. Remember this first servant, he asked, be patient and I'll pay it back. Remember what the king said? He didn't say, okay, I'll give you a few more years to gather up that $3.5 billion. He said, you know what? Okay, it's gone. It's completely gone, right? So, remember this verse. Jesus teaches in Matthew 5, if you're offering your gift at the altar and remember that your brother or sister has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar. First go and be reconciled to them, then come and offer your gift. This idea of asking for mercy, asking for forgiveness, whether you have something against someone else or someone else has something against you, it's an important part of Jesus' teachings. And this is why it's hard. This is why it's hard. I was trying to come up with a word in this message to use here, trying to figure out, what do we call that? Going to someone and asking for forgiveness. And I kept coming up with words that we don't really use in our language anymore. The word contrition came to mind, like being contrite. And so I'm like looking up online in the thesaurus, you know, kind of trying to come up with these words. And a word like contrition, I see, and then, you know, they always have the little graph. Have you ever seen this when you look it up sometimes online? There's a graph of word usage, you know, from the year 1800 to today. And the year, like the word contrition peaked in like the middle or the early part of the 19th century, and it's just been all the way down since then. And nobody uses the word contrition anymore. And I think it's because we don't even understand what that means. To go to somebody and be contrite. To go to somebody and be penitent. That's another one. The graph goes, poof. Nobody uses the word penitent anymore. Are you penitent? What does it mean to be penitent? It means to go to someone and say, I've done something wrong. It's like we're losing those words in our vocabulary because it's so hard for us English speakers, for some reason in our culture, to admit that and to go to somebody and say, please forgive me. That's what Jesus is talking about. Going to someone. There are two sides to this, right? Maybe someone's offended you and they need to come to you and you need to offer forgiveness if they do come to you. But maybe you're the one that needs to go to someone and say, I am contrite. I am penitent. Forgive me. Forgive me for offending you. That's what's required. Reconciliation. If this verse here, Jesus is saying, you know what? Reconciliation trumps religiosity. Before you go be religious, go be reconciled. That's Jesus' message here. You've been forgiven $3.5 billion worth. Don't you think you can muster the strength to go and reconcile with somebody who may owe you $6,000? That's the point of the parable. That's what Jesus is saying. But the other thing that's required, besides the contrition or the penitent heart, is, listen to this, the Lord of that slave felt compassion and released him and forgave his debt. I changed translations on you. This is the New American Standard. Some translations say took pity on him, like the NIV says took pity, but many translations use this word compassion. And I wanted to use the word compassion mainly because it started with a C, and contrition and compassion, they work well together. No, that's not why. I like the word compassion. The idea that when you want to reconcile with someone, yes, we need to have that idea of coming and asking for forgiveness, but we also need to have compassion. And how hard is it sometimes to have compassion on people who have wronged you? That's the call. That's what Jesus is asking. This servant, I don't know how he racked up $3.5 billion, but it couldn't have been good. But whatever it was, the king, the master, looked at him and felt in his heart deeply compassion for this human being, for this human soul. And he said, it's okay. I forgive you. That's the compassion of the kingdom of God for us. That's the compassion that God has for you and for me and for all the things that keep us away from God, for all the brokenness in our lives and from all the things that we've done that we shouldn't have done. And God says, it's gone now, as far as the east is from the west. And I think Jesus is telling us that we are to emulate that kind of compassion in our relationships so we can reconcile. So forgiveness is something that we do, probably by not doing what we feel we're entitled to do when someone wrongs us or offends us. Forgiveness is often hindered by a self-righteous anger that can come if we're not careful. And let me also say that I know sometimes when you get forgiven, very often the opposite happens. You get that sense of humility, and it really bumps up your compassion for others who go through the same things. And I know that is true many times also. But there is sometimes that tendency to self-righteousness, and so we want to avoid that. And then the last thing, remember that forgiveness is about reconciliation. The word forgive, every time it's used in the New Testament, it means an action. When we use it, we use sort of a 18th century moral philosophy version of that word, which means a state of mind, like a sense in our heart that we have let go of whatever bad feelings we have towards someone. That's not what Jesus is talking about at all. He's talking about an action of actually reconciling one life with another life. That's what forgiveness is in this story. And I think that's important for us to remember. And I wish I could stand up here and say, you know, yay, rah, rah, go win one for the Gipper, go out and do it. But I know how hard it is. Forgiveness is hard. And this is why we're in community. Because there are times maybe in your life when you can't forgive somebody, and maybe you need to come and we need to talk about that, and we need to pray about that and pray for you so you can try to reconcile. But the goal is reconciliation. The goal is reconciliation. And we stand on the truth, whether you feel like it or not, we stand on the truth that God has removed the consequences of our mistakes as far as the East is from the West. He's forgiven us. And if we can stand in that truth, then maybe we can dig deep and find some compassion for those who have wronged us.